Where do we find God? Or yet, where do we go looking for him? It's truly remarkable, you know, when we look at Scripture from Kings, when we look at this gospel from Matthew, each one is kind of picking off from a prior story. It's kind of like they came to a halfway point and they sort of cut us off and they're just sort of picking up and running with it here. You know, we've got Elijah here on the side of the mountain. And of course, it's worthy to reflect on how Elijah found himself on the side of the mountain. Realize that this follows immediately from the events where Elijah challenges the people of God. They've started worshiping other gods. They've really taken interest in the prophet Baal. They have 450 prophets for the god Baal. They're by himself. So he challenges the people. He says, let's look at this seriously. If the Lord is God, worship him. If Baal is God, worship him. And they build the two altars, and the prophets of Baal are supposed to call down fire for their altar, and they spend all day doing it. And Elijah makes fun of them all day because they can't do it. And then he builds the altar of God, and he calls for fire, and God sends down the fire and proves that the Lord is God. The people say they're going to respond to whoever brings fire. They think this is a fair agreement. Elijah is following as God instructed. God instructed him to do this. He's following through on what he was supposed to do. However, at the end of the event, the prophets of Baal are proven wrong. The Lord has proven God. And the people, instead of worshiping the Lord, the king wants to seek his life. And by the king, his wife wants Elijah dead. And as if you've ever been married, you know, if your wife wants it, so do you. So now Elijah is being sought for his life. And so he's gone to the mountain. He's gone to the mountain to hide. And yet he's there because that is exactly what God has asked him to do. He's led all the way up to that point. But after putting himself out, doing everything that he asked, doing everything that God asked of him, now he's really kind of drained. And he doesn't have the strength to save his own life. So he's there on the mountain waiting for instruction. He's waiting for God. In some ways, we don't see it so very different in this gospel. Jesus has fed the people. Remember, we're literally picking up from last week's gospel. He fed the 5,000, or the 5,000 men, not including women and children. So he's fed thousands and thousands of people. And he sends the apostles. He says, get in the boat. I'll dismiss the crowds. I'll meet you on the other side. Realize they don't actually stop and ask him, how are you going to beat us to the other side since we are currently taking the fastest form of transportation to get to the other side? And yet you say you're going to beat us there. But sure, we'll get in the boat. We'll give it a shot. We'll go for that anyway. And they don't seem to be getting anywhere. The wind is against them, and they're going on and on. I mean, if they're in the fourth watch of the night and they still haven't crossed the sea, they're really not making a lot of headway. They're struggling. They're trying. And yet even Jesus has poured himself out. He's fed the 5,000. He just found out about the death of John the Baptist, his cousin. He's poured himself out, doing everything he's supposed to. And he goes up to the mountain to pray. It's that reminder that we need to keep coming back to God, but it really is a great thought to consider for a moment. Where are we looking for God? How are we looking for God? When we're following along, how do we come to this? You know, I was thinking about where we find God, and I was thinking about it. I went over to visit a friend of mine just before I was ordained, and I went, according to him, I went to his house very early in the morning to bother him very early in the morning. It's about 10:45, but you know, I suppose our definitions of early in the morning are different. I tried to explain to him that if breakfast is shut down at McDonald's, we can no longer call it early in the morning, but it wasn't Saturday, so I didn't go to 11. It closed at 10:30. Breakfast was over, and I was over there afterwards, and I was there early in the morning. And we were sitting on his couch, we were, you know, solving the world's problems, and there was a knock at his door. And I said to him, I said, are you expecting anyone? He said, nope. I haven't even showered yet. I'm going to go down to the basement to the bathroom and you go ahead and answer the door. And I thought, sure, I'll just answer the door. That sounds like it makes sense. So I opened the door and there are two young men standing there in black pants, black ties, and white shirts and holding a book in their hand. And one of them said to me, he said, have you found Jesus? And I said, I didn't know he was missing. Have you put up posters? What was the last place you saw him? Perhaps we can form a search party based on that. Obviously, the conversation didn't go very well. They got very frustrated and left. That didn't go out so very well. But it does beg that question, you know, how are we looking for God? How are we encountering, how are we looking for God? And I think it's such a critical moment here. Because Elijah is told that God's going to pass by. He's ready for it, kind of. And there's a mighty wind. I've seen a lot of mighty winds, but it says that there's a mighty wind that crushed rocks. Now, that's got to be something of a wind. And then there's fire. Well, there's the earthquake. And then there's fire. There's incredible crashing, this loud, powerful, overwhelming sounds. Wind and earthquake and fire. And Elijah doesn't run. He waits for God. He waits for him. And he comes in a whisper. He comes in this tiniest of sounds. Despite the fact that it's been loud, despite the fact that it's one loud event after another, with the wind and the earthquake and the fire, he comes in the softest of sound. And he comes to us in silence. And you think about this, when we come to the gospel, and what happens? They're on the sea, and they're trying to cross, and it's late, and it's the fourth watch of the night. I mean, this is dark. This is early morning, pre-dawn, just when it's totally black, and you can't see a thing, and the wind is pushing and whipping at them, and it's throwing the water, and they can't get through anything. And what do they see? They see someone walking on water. It's not a stretch to think a ghost is now trying to come to harass them and make fun of them while they fail to get across the sea. And they cry out in fear. And Jesus responds, and he says, "Take courage. Don't be scared. It's me." Which I think is really impressive, because usually when I'm out on the water and I see wind and water whipping up and I see someone in the distance, whenever they say something to me, the only thing I say in return is, "What?" Because there's nothing you can hear at that point. It's so loud and it's chaotic and it's, everything's going on. And God comes in quiet. He comes in the stillness. I remember growing up, someone told me God comes in the silence, and I thought, I'm never going to hear God if he comes in the silence. I have five brothers and sisters. Have you ever been to my house? It's always loud. There's always something going on. There's always something that's making noise, that's continuing on. It didn't even matter when we all passed into adolescence and adults. We're still really loud, apparently. I go home, there's only three or four of them home. They're still really loud all the time. How do I hear God in the silence? Well, I think this scripture actually points out something very important to us. God comes in the silence. He comes in the whisper to Elijah. He comes in the stillness of Jesus. He comes in the quiet. But it's not that he's afraid of the noise. He comes despite the noise. He comes no matter what other craziness is going on around us. No matter what other things have come apart around us, no matter what chaos we've endured in our lives, we follow after God, and we're following God, and we're doing His will, and we're doing what we're supposed to be doing, and we're trying to do it to the best of our ability, and we keep pushing at it, and we keep pushing at it, and we find ourselves tired, and then we ask, where is God? Elijah had done everything he was supposed to, and now he's asking, where is God? The apostles had done exactly what they were instructed, and they're starting to wonder why they stopped in the water, where is God? By itself, but it goes even one step further, doesn't it? Because Jesus says, "Take courage, it is I." And Peter says, "If so, if that really is you, tell me to come out onto the water." Ever face that in our own lives, where we're doing what we're supposed to, we're following after God, and then we're having that low moment, we're having that difficult time, where we feel a little cut off, we feel a little isolated. We ask for a sign from God. We ask for a consolation. We ask for something to remind us that we're on the path. And God says, "Do you really want that? If you really need that, all right, step out onto the water." And we take that step. And we come out onto the water. As long as Peter's looking at Christ, as long as he's focused on God and where he's supposed to be, as long as he's focused on where he's going, he's fine. It's only when he stops to look around. It's only when he stops to take in the wind and the water and it occurs to him that he's not supposed to be able to do this. It's only when he stops and realizes that this isn't actually something he's supposed to be able to do by himself. It's kind of like the Wile E. Coyote after he's walked over the cliff. You know, he looks down and he realizes that he's not really supposed to be standing on the air. And it's once he's acknowledged that suddenly he loses sight of what he was supposed to do in the first place. And he begins to drown. And this is the part I find most interesting. This is truly, in my opinion, the most curious part of this gospel. Peter begins to drown, and he cries out, "Lord, save me." And what does it say? It doesn't say Jesus ran over. It doesn't say Jesus suddenly caused him to stop drowning. It says he reached out his arm and he grabbed him. You mean to tell me he was within arm's reach of God, and he still forgot what he was doing? It's a remarkable thing to me. I do it all the time. I'm regularly screwing up. I'm really good at it. It's, you know, the image is right there on the side of my wall, and I look at it, and I think about that so often, because right there, within arm's reach, there's Peter, and he begins to drown, and he cries out, "Lord, save me." Jesus grabs him. He's right there. He says, "Why did you doubt me? Why did you doubt me?" I think it's such an important reminder to us that we can be doing everything right, that we can be headed on the path the way that we're supposed to. We can follow after God with everything that we have and follow after Him with everything that we're trying to do. And sometimes we still need that reminder that God is there. And that's okay. He invited Peter out by the water. We need that reminder. We ask for it. Peter says to God, he says, "If it's really you, tell me to come out." But never underestimate that when we struggle, that when we're having a hard time, even when we fail, we cry out to God, and He immediately grabs us. Sure, there might be a little reproach involved, but He immediately grabs us. Never forget that God is never outside our reach. He is never more than our calling away. And even in the loudest, even in the chaos, even when we're not sure we can even hear ourselves think, God comes in the stillness if we're listening.